Welcome back. You can hear my weekly radio program, The Conspiracy Show, Sunday nights at 11 p.m. Eastern out of Toronto on Zoomer Radio. For a complete list of affiliates, go to my website, strangeplanet.ca, strangeplanet.ca. If you'd like, you can click on the radio page there for The Conspiracy Show. And again, just go to the affiliates page and all of the stations there are listed. Also, say hello on Twitter at Richard Serrett. We are just a few days away from 2016, and my wish for you is that the new year brings you health, joy, prosperity, and if you're single, my wish for you is that this is the year you find someone special to share your life with. And with that in mind, why not give ParanormalDate.com a try? It's especially designed with coast-to-coast listeners like you in mind. That certain someone is out there now, perhaps listening to this show, and ParanormalDate.com can help bring you or can help you find them. Make 2016 your year to meet your soulmate. ParanormalDate.com, now available for your mobile device. ParanormalDate.com. You are not alone. Back with more of my conversation with Scott and Suzanne Ramsey as we discuss the Aztec UFO incident right here on Coast to Coast AM. All right, a quick recap. So, March 25th, 1948, a spacecraft 100 feet in diameter crash lands, remains relatively intact on Hart Canyon Mesa near Aztec, New Mexico. And within a certain period of time, the place is crawling with oil field workers, police, other witnesses, literally crawling all over this craft, poking and prodding it. Some dozen or more alien bodies, all dead, are seen in the craft. Now, Scott and Suzanne, at what point does the military arrive, and what happens once they're on the scene?
It was late morning, based on the memory of everybody that we interviewed. And some apparently flew into Durango Airport, on a C-47, which would be the military version of the DC-3, and or some type of transport plane, we're not sure which. And then the ground vehicle showed up after that. Now, keep in mind that earlier Suzanne talked about a kind of a scout helicopter. We're still trying to figure out where that came from because it didn't have that much range. Those were the early helicopters. The Sikorsky and the early Bells both had helicopters out at that time. They were similar to the helicopters used in the beginning opening scenes of MASH, you know, kind of a Lexan bubbled two-seater.
Right, right.
And it didn't have much range. And we have really been working hard with some aircraft historians. Mike Price has really jumped in and helped us over the years, trying to figure out where it could have taken off and come from. And it just might be as simple as Los Alamos. But so we had a helicopter by air, some people coming down from the Durango Airport, and then ground vehicles that could have come from Kirtland Air Force Base. But keep in mind that back then, you had two-lane roads from Albuquerque all the way up. And that would have taken a lot of time. So there's still some question marks on where the military did arrive from. But basically, they get there, they kind of contain everybody, break everybody up from a group into individuals, interview them, who are they, what were they doing there, who they work for, name, rank, you know, serial number, kind of so to speak. And then tell them that this is of the utmost national security. They're not to talk about it. And basically threaten each one of them. You know, keep in mind, again, we're 19 to 20, 21, 22-year-old kids. And send them on their merry way. They were there the better part of the day by the time they were released. Any vehicles that were there for the oil field workers are searched for cameras, or the oil field workers are searched for cameras as well. Mr. and Mrs. Knight, the ranchers that were there, they were separated away from the kids and talked to. They were probably released relatively early. And with the fear of God put in them, these guys didn't talk about it. Doug Nolan told me years later, he's riding down the road with his boss, Bill Ferguson, and brought it up, and Bill Ferguson, who was senior to him by 10 or 15 years, said, remember, Doug, we're never supposed to talk about that. I think you,
when you say, excuse me, Scott, when you say they put the fear of God in them, can you get specific about the nature of the threats?
Well, Doug said they were actually threatened with their life if they talked about it. Ken Farley had similar words. Actually, Ken Farley got mouthy with the one group of soldiers that were interrogating him, using the old young kid, hey, I'm not in the military, you can't tell me what to tell a civilian. They roughed them up a little bit. And so they were, the military was showing they were very serious about what level of keep your mouth shut that they were talking about.
I might add one thing, too, in regards to the military. They had no identifying marks, military marks. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit, hon?
Yeah, the... Yeah, of course, you got Ken Farley that had briefly been in the Navy, and that's a whole other book. But Ken said that they did not have Army or Air Force, the Air Force, you know, newly created Air Force 47. They did not have insignias on them that would identify what service they were from. The trucks as well, they were very bland and generic looking. And later,
care to speculate on the significance of that? I mean, could they have been Office of Strategic Services?
Well, they could have been an elite group. We talk about Fred Reed in the book. He had worked on an elite cleanup crew and ended up in April of 1948 at the crash site. And because we had V-2 rockets screaming overhead, prototype bombers, prototype fighter jets, the P-80, that if something did crash, New Mexico back then was crawling with Soviet spies. I mean, there's many books written on that because of Los Alamos, Sandia National Labs, whatnot. White Sands Missile Range, you know, that was a big draw to the Soviets. And they did, when they did have something go off stream or go errant to a crash point, they did have groups that would come in and do everything, as Fred Reed said, if we could have, we would have vacuumed where these objects crashed, meaning V-2s and aircraft. When they were sent to the crash site back in April, a few weeks after this object was removed, they went there to remove bits and pieces of whatever crashed. They were there to re-landscape the crash site because there was a lot of heavy terrain marks, heavy equipment type things, and human debris such as cigarette butts, toiletry items, that type of thing that they had to remove.
So that leads me to my next area of inquiry, and that has to do with the physical evidence. As you've just detailed, the military personnel did a pretty thorough job. No need to, there wasn't a lot of debris. They as you say, they had to re-landscape. But, mm-hmm. I mean, was, of course, in the Roswell case, we had Jesse Marcel and the tiny eye beam with the hieroglyphics, and we had that strange, mm-hmm. malleable material that would sort of, you know, could roll it up into a ball and it would pop back into shape and so forth. Was there anything like that floating around Aztec, you know, that somebody managed to sneak past the military?
No, not that we've been able to find in our coming up on 20, 29 years. There's a little bit of physical evidence at the crash site today that brings pause. Did you have time to read any parts of the book at all?
I did, yes, but I'd like you to recount that for our listeners.
Sure. We talk about the concrete slab, and a road was cut into that mesa, which is still visible today, and unless it has appeared here recently on any Bureau of Land Management maps, that road is we call it the Mystery Military Road. Wasn't on any maps back 46, 48 through the 50s, not on any maps as of March of 2015 when we were out there. Somebody cut a road to get something down on that mesa. And the road is still there, the mystery road, and the concrete slab, which we were told was used as a footer for a crane pad, because after they cut the road through there, that terrain is that soil is very silty, very sandy, very silty. And we interviewed a gentleman that was not at the crash site, but was involved in the recovery operation from the Roswell Army Airfield. And he explained, look for a concrete footer, because we had to, we delayed the operation because we actually had to pour concrete. And Randy Barnes, I got to give him credit, he went out with a piece of steel rebar and was poking around in the silt until he found it. Bill Steinman actually found it in 86, but we didn't know that, and all the erosion and the wind blowing out there blew quite a bit of sand back over it. So we had to uncover that, and of course, you know, we did some field tests on that through a laboratory.
We do have, in Scully's book, and when you track some of the scientists, there was reported that they had taken some of the pieces of the craft, but that's not something that we could actually document.
Of course, Roswell has the General Ramey memo. Is there an equivalent with the Aztec UFO incident?
In a way, we have it in the book. After the craft is removed, and you know, it's speculation on our part, and I think everybody's part, that it was taken to Wright-Patterson. But that would have been one of the places that it could have been taken to, or it could have been taken right to Los Alamos, or right to Sandia National Labs, for that matter. The one interesting piece of evidence was a sting operation that was done in downtown Denver at the Edelweiss Bar, where both the CIA, FBI, and Army counterintelligence, and not to leave out the Air Force, set up a sting operation to recover photographs, and this is their language, not ours, of the Aztec flying saucer that a gentleman had, that he was trying to sell them to a Baltimore Sun-Times reporter. And somehow the military agencies got wind of it and went there and set up the sting operation in the bar. And, of course, when they apprehended the man, he had no photos on him, and claimed it was a prank and that it was just a joke. But the interesting thing, we really delve into that. The reporter from the Baltimore Sun-Times did not exist. We went through all the HR records and even talked to other reporters at the time. So whoever this person that was there to receive the photographs and told authorities, hey, I'm a reporter, I'm just doing my job, did not exist at all. And the person that was selling the photographs in the FBI memo says he claimed it was a hoax, but we don't believe him. So they're basically saying, we actually believe he had photographs of the Aztec flying saucer. And, you know, we make a claim about our 55,000 documents. It's probably more than that. Now, those aren't documents that everyone talks about a flying saucer in Aztec, New Mexico, but they're all very supportive documents. Suzanne was explaining that somebody claims they lived in Aztec, we pull their tax records to make sure they lived there at that time. If somebody claims they worked for El Paso Gas, we pull their records to make sure they were working for the company at the time. So we have accumulated a lot of backup documentation to our research.
Tell me about some of the other, I guess, more prominent pieces of documentation. You mentioned 55,000 pieces. Mm-hmm. Some of the more, I guess, poignant or important documents that you feature in the book.
Well, going back to earlier conversations, some of the ones I feel are interesting are correspondence between Silas Newton, Leo Gebauer, and Frank Scully back in 1950 when this story first broke. Some of the other interesting documents are, we went to the University of Wyoming in Laramie, Mike Price and I, a few years back, and we took the old wire-to-wire recordings and had those converted to CD with, of course, the help of the library. And these are all conversations, speeches, lectures, and interviews that were done back in 1950 to 1953. And one was a interview that was done with two Air Force intelligence officers and George Kohler from Denver. I know people listening to your show are going to say that means nothing to them. George Kohler was friends of Silas Newton and Leo Gebauer and was there the night a big lecture was done at the University of Denver. But it's interesting that the Air Force guys do not know they're being interviewed. And here, after all these years, Mike and I, with the help of the archives at the University of Wyoming, found it. And there's some pretty incriminating things said by the Air Force intelligence officers on that tape.
Yeah,
such as?
They didn't know that they were being taped. They knew they were doing the interviewing, but they didn't know they were being taped.
Right.
They
and
George Kohler was recording the conversation the whole time.
And you said they said some pretty incriminating things. Can you give us a instance?
And Kohler, of course, being a radio guy, is setting these guys up, knowing that he's recording and then knowing that they don't know they're being recorded. But Kohler was saying, you know, you guys are being really tough on the people that are making claims about seeing flying saucers, and why are you keeping it a big secret? And they said, because the American public has no right to know about it. And it's an internal thing with the government and the Air Force. That's something that they would not say if they on the record if they knew they were being recorded. So they're basically admitting the whole UFO situation back in the 50s is real, and the American public don't have any need to know about it.
Is there any document trail or any evidence? You say you're speculating that it likely went to Wright-Patterson Air Force a base, but is there any documentation, any witnesses at that end that makes that speculation maybe more credible?
Interviewing some people back in 98, 99, we interviewed a gentleman like that I mentioned earlier, told us about Look for the Concrete Footer. We found him in retirement. His name, for some reason, was not redacted out of the Air Force files that we went through the Freedom of Information Act to get. I don't know if it was a quick oversight on their part or what, but people are a creature of habits, and we went through the records and found out he had actually retired back in his small town up in the Northeast. And I went and interviewed him not once but twice back in the late 90s. His whole recollection of where that craft would have gone, and he openly admitted to me that it was a flying saucer recovery. And I brought with him all the documents that I had declassified from the Air Force. So he could sit there and see that, you know, we were very aggressively trying to get to the bottom of this. And his speculation was that after the craft was moved to wherever it was moved to, his job was to keep tabs of the assets that were involved. He told us it was about 200 people involved in the recovery. And I asked him, where do you think the final destination was? He said, that is so compartmentalized, I would never know that. But some of the vehicles that we used, which was the Dragon Wagon, it was a tank transport vehicle, big flatbed, capable of carrying a lot of weight. He said they were sitting at Los Alamos, and he had to get those back down to Holloman Air Force Base. So for some reason, something, you know, the way that it is described how the craft came apart in sections, because you're not going to move a 100-foot diameter craft off a mesa out in New Mexico. But at least some of the parts look like they had gone to Los Alamos.
That's interesting. I was going to ask you how you managed to move something that large, 100 feet in diameter, on flatbed trucks from this isolated mesa without, you know, anyone taking notice. But you're saying it came apart in sections. Still, there must have been
no rivets or bolts or anything. It actually pieced together.
Fascinating. All right, we'll take a time out, come back, continue our conversation about the Aztec UFO incident. Scott Ramsey, Suzanne Ramsey, right here on Coast to Coast AM. Coming up in hours 3 and 4, Daniel Estulin, the author of The True Story of the Bilderberg Group. He's back with another blockbuster, and this one is Tavistock Institute, Social Engineering the Masses. Hey, I wanted to invite you to join Coast to Coast AM's George Norrie for dynamic discussion on paranormal phenomena, conspiracies, and all things unexplained on Beyond Belief TV. To subscribe to this amazing internet TV show, go to beyondbelief.com. A brand new episode coming your way on January the 6th. Get this provocative title, The Fun of Dying, featuring Roberta Grimes. Roberta explains that the fun of dying is actually a rallying cry to live your life to the fullest. That's Beyond Belief TV. You can sign up and watch for one full month for just 99 cents. Visit beyondbelief.com. All right, phone calls, your questions and comments for Scott and Suzanne Ramsey, author of The Aztec UFO Incident. That's coming up next on Coast to Coast AM. Scott and Suzanne Ramsey are here, co-authors, along with Frank Thayer, of The Aztec UFO Incident. Scott, Suzanne, you ready to dive into some calls?
Oh, you absolutely.
All right, let's go east of the Rockies. Harriet is in Kentucky. Harriet, welcome to Coast to Coast. All right, we've lost her. Harriet, let's say hi to Robert on the wildcard line. He's in Culver City. Robert, hello.
Yeah, Scott, Harriet. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about an experience I had myself, similar to the one you talked about. In somewhere in the early 1950s, I went to a camp out here in Los Angeles called Camp Max Strauss. My mom sent me out there, packed me off, and I was about 12 or 13. I think it was about my bar mitzvah period of time, 13, and up at Camp Max Strauss, we were walking back one evening out of the hills there, and there's a place called Star Peak and an Indian corral up there called Box Canyon. There's a lot of lore associated with it, with the Indians. Basically, what had happened was, excuse me, I've got a little cold, a couple kids, as we were going up to our cabins about twilight, said they had seen four or five flying saucers shoot in the canyon. The group I was with, we said we didn't see anything. Next morning, I was awakened to engines and some sort of engine or piston-like noise. I thought it was a manufacturing plant, possibly. It was pounding, and I was going to go out, kind of afraid to go out because, I don't know, something came over me. I couldn't get out of my bed. I was looking out the window. And all of a sudden, out of the canyon was gigantic. Well, it was pretty large, about two-story high, silver metallic disc. Came up over the canyon, about 50 to 100 feet over the top of the hills. It had green flames, like you were talking about, it shooting around the whole circumference. It looked like a meteorite. It stood up in the hills for about 10 minutes, made a 45-degree angle shot. Then stayed there for another 5 or 10 and shot out past, I think it was Star Peak, which looked like it might be a beacon. And when we went up there, the Indians claimed 100 years earlier to the year, possibly to the day, another craft had come down there. They stole the Indians' horses. That's what we learned before actually this actually happened, this sighting I had. And basically the kids said it was five UFOs, and I saw the meteorite when it came up in the morning, about twilight, dawn, I guess it was.
All right, Robert. Well, Scott and Suzanne, there's a lead for you, maybe another book in the making.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway,
it
sounds
another
like
28 years.
What a camp experience you had, huh?
I mean, I could never get that out of my mind. I mean, I just looked at it for 10 minutes from the cabin I was in. I was trying to wake some of the kids up, and I just couldn't do it. I was like, Petra, I was just looking at the thing. I mean, I was like mesmerized by it. I just couldn't actually even move out of my bed. I felt almost paralyzed by it. I don't know what it was, but it was. And the thing was, as I say, 100 years earlier to the day or the possibly, for sure the year, I remember it, and possibly to the day or week or month, I can't remember exactly, but they said, you've come up here at a very opportune time. An unusual event occurred about 100 years ago, I think it was for sure the year, And basically that was the event that the Indians said gods came out of the sky, the whole deal. They told us a basic story about it up at Camp Strauss up there. But anyway.
All right, Robert, I appreciate that. That beats my summer camp all to hell. All we did was archery and make wallets. Let's go east of the Rockies. Hunter is in South Carolina. Hunter, welcome to Coast to Coast. Welcome.
Hey, how we doing, Richard? And I just want to know, what exact, like, are the accounts of the Aztecs or any other Indians have with UFOs? Like, are they, like, godlike figures, them, or?
You're referring to what happened in Aztec? Were they godlike figures?
Yeah, were they godlike figures, like an ancient astronaut? Were they like godlike figures to them?
Well, are there any? I'm not sure what tribes are in New Mexico, but what did they? Did you interview any of the local aboriginals at the time that were living there, and what did they have to say about this?
Let me clarify something. Aztec, New Mexico, is a small town. And it was named Aztec because when early settlers came upon it, they thought that it was the Aztec Indians that there were runes from. It was not. So it gets a little confusing about that, especially when we study different things with ancient aliens. Aztecs as a people come into play. But I don't know if that clarifies it any, but this is Aztec, New Mexico. It's a small town. We are familiar with, although we did not regarding the book, but many of the tribes, the Navajo, the Apache, the Comanche, have very interesting experiences with, I guess you would call it, their gods and their descriptions. They have the ant people. They have, it's fascinating even to go out and look at the petroglyphs, what would appear to be alien beings. Is that where you were going?
I think that's where he was going, yes. Okay. We didn't touch on, I mentioned Jesse Marcel, both junior and senior, talked about strange glyphs on the, particularly on the I-beam. Did any of the witnesses talk about any lettering or writing on the craft?
Bill Stein that goes into that in his book, where some of the people he talked with, and that book was 1986, that there was some hieroglyphic type writings on the what we would call a control panel or with the cockpit of the craft.
But and how would you describe, how did he describe the glyphs?
From the people he interviewed, they were like ancient Egyptian type of writing. And when you're dealing with 19 and 20-year-old kids, they don't really know what they're looking at. They just say there was some weird writing on there.
All right, the wild card line, Sean is in Columbus, Ohio. Welcome to Coast, Sean.
Hello. How are you tonight? I just had a quick question. I mean, based on what you've been saying, you said the craft came apart. It didn't have any bolts or rivets, but it came apart in sections. And it sounds like the military had it out of there pretty quickly. So it sounds to me like the military knew what they were doing in disassembling the craft.
That's an excellent point.
Yeah, we didn't really get into that too much, but in reading the details of the description, and by the way, it looks like it took 2 weeks to get the craft out of there. The craft was held together with what we would call today pit pins, like we use. Suzanne and I have a farm here, and all your implements on a tractor are held together with pit pins. Experimental aircraft use them. It's a very tight tolerance pin. And reading Scully's description on how the craft came apart, it seems like that is what they were doing. They had pins that would go up through the structure and hold it together. And based on how the craft came apart, we did a reenactment back 2 years before the book came out, 2010, where we did a reenactment of moving the craft of pieces that size out of Hart Canyon and down to the main highway. If that answers your question.
that answered my question. Thank you.
Okay, all right. Thank you very much for the call. Talk to me about the scientists that you tracked down that claimed that they worked on this craft.
We never interviewed any of the scientists that worked on the craft. We pieced together from the descriptions and the projects that were going on at the time. Frank Scully, who, again, broke the story back in 1950, 2 years after the event happened, claimed that there were 8 to 9 scientists that the military brought in to work on the craft. And in his description of the scientists, he gave us enough that today, with what we have at our fingertips, computers, Freedom of Information Act, the power of that, we went digging for who worked on what projects during World War II that had education that he describes and worked on projects. For an example, he claims one of the scientists worked on a magnetic device that helped find Japanese submarines. And that was a lead, and we found the company was GSI, which later became, by the way, Texas Instruments, and that there were scientists assigned to that through the War Department that did, in fact, work on that and were active when this event happened in 1948. So that was probably the longest piece of single research we did for our first book, and continuing, by the way, into our second book.
But there's ways that we track, too. We tracked also their travel, where they traveled, some of the things that they were doing additionally from their professional life, and were able to track and narrow down much more closely.
And did you come up with any names?
Oh, yeah.
We know who they are.
A whole group of names. I think Carl Hyland was probably the main scientist that worked on the project. He died fairly young. He died in 1958, if memory is correct. And he was born, I think, in 1899, so he was pretty young. All the scientists, unfortunately, have passed by now. The last one, ironically, died right about the time our research was really heating up. But again, these were mature people back in 1948, 1950, add 67 going on 68 years to it. You know, we're pushing these guys in their 90s to 100 years old.
There's one that really stands out in my mind, and he was a scientist who was very highly regarded in the world, and he was also a professor, and his students, he was so modest of a person that he, whenever on papers that would be a compilation of several people doing them, he always put his name, either didn't include his name or put his name at the bottom. Very, very modest man who did not like to draw attention to himself. In fact, we have papers that we found of his colleagues noting over the years of how modest he was. And then at the time of the Aztec incident, he takes a trip out to the southwest. When he comes back to Minnesota, where he lives, he calls together an international conference, and he is the main speaker. It's all about him at this point. His personality changed remarkably. And up until this point, he's been working on projects for the war and you know, furthering that. He comes back from the southwest. He calls together his colleagues, and he gets up and gives a speech of how something that he has just experienced and seen will change the world, that we have the ability, based on information that he saw, would no longer have to have hunger. We would have no problems with fuel. He lists all these things. And his life from that point, although he didn't live much longer after that, his life changes so remarkably and to really furthering man's, I don't even know what word I want to use. It's just a kinder, gentler person. He just changes so remarkably. And it's so exciting when you come upon a little nugget like that.
Right. It's amazing how you sort of pieced that together and found that piece of the puzzle and found exactly where it sort of fit. Let's go back to the phones. First time caller Andrew is in North Carolina. Andrew, good morning. Welcome to Coast.
Good morning to you. How are you?
Well, thank you.
I just had a comment and then a question for your two guests. When I was a kid visiting my dad down in Florida, we've been near Pensacola, so I was used to seeing, jets and helicopters and all that. And there was one morning about 7, we were driving down the road, beautiful day, clear skies, and in the air, I saw an object, cylinder in shape, and spherical, I'm sorry, and it was going faster than what the jet would, and there was no smoke trail behind it. It was going left directly above. It was very tiny in size. And then it changed direction and then suddenly just, flew off and disappeared. And it's just one of my strange experiences that I've had with that. And myself, I'm actually in the military, so I wanted to ask the people that you interviewed that were sworn to secrecy by the military, are they worried at all the fact that their names are now out in the public, that they have come out with this Aztec incident?
Sadly, they've passed away. And so most of them we were able to get to before they passed away, and they felt like they needed to get this information out. They sat on it for most of their life. Some of them never told anyone, even their spouses, until they were near death. And some of the other ones would speak about it, but only in close quarters with their family. So sadly, they're passed away, so that's really not an issue.
All right, Andrew, thank you for the call. Do you believe, Scott and Suzanne, that the Aztec UFO incident deserves to be... where do you rank it in terms of Roswell? I don't know if that's if you consider that even a fair question, but I think it's more significant.
You've had less people research Aztec. I mean, obviously, you've had Scully, you'd have Simon, Richard Ogden, Frank Thayer, Suzanne, and I. Bill Simon has come back out of retirement. By the way, he helped us with this book. We talk to him now probably every other day. Mike Price, on our first book, we had Frank Warren from UFO Chronicles really jump in and help quite a bit. You know, I don't know how many books are written on Roswell. There's got to be hundreds at this point. But Aztec was definitely the diamond in the rough. It was, it kind of lay dormant, as we discussed. It was discredited so quickly. But I think it's as intriguing, if not more intriguing. I don't want to take anything away from all the hard work that people did with Roswell. But it's so difficult now to go back 67, 68 years later and piece together the crime. And we've been doing it over a period of going on 29 years. But I think it certainly has its part in the history books of history and in the studies of flying saucers. I think it deserves some kind of good notoriety there.
To be sure. Scott and Suzanne, I appreciate your time tonight. I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The Aztec UFO incident. Coming up, the Tavistock Institute, Social Engineering, the Masses, with Daniel Eschelin, right here on Coast to Coast AM. My name is Richard Serrett.